Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. And today we're welcoming special guest Todd Plant. You guys might know him from Eyewitness. You guys might know him from Millennium. And there's a bunch of other stuff we're going to talk about tonight. But Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Cool. I'm glad we got this all figured out with the audio and we're ready to go.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna hand you off to Tom here because I know he wants to start with some of that early stuff of your career, and we're gonna kind of wind our way through that and get out to the current.
All right, sounds good.
So I wanted to talk to you about the band Cutthroat, which there was a name change at some point to Atomic Cocktail, and how that band came off the ground and why there was a name change with the band.
Hey, this was like late '80s, and I was in the Navy. I got, you know, married and had a kid, and all of a sudden I'm, you know, working two jobs, and my second job is delivering pizza. So I deliver pizza at this place, this house, and the band, there's a band in the garage, and they had ordered the pizza. So I went in, hey, you guys are pretty good. Hey, you know any singers? Yeah, I'm a singer. Okay, so that's how I got the gig.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
It was kind of like we were really like Judas Priest kind of.
Exactly what it sounds like, yeah.
Kind of glammy.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit late for that. Maybe late 80s was, you know, like the time had passed. But and we were called Thunder. Never heard of those other names. The band was called Thunder before we had even heard of the English group.
Right.
And we played around and for a couple of years and did some recording, made some demos in Morrisound. And the band broke up. We moved on. And years later, I heard, oh, there's an Atomic Cocktail release. So that came first. And I knew nothing about it. It was basically they just took the master tapes and called it something else. This was the guitar player who's no longer with us, so I can't sue him.
Hmm.
But so he got a deal. I don't know what kind of, it was a cassette thing or CD. And then years later, like 2000 something, all of a sudden this Cutthroat, I'd never heard of it. That's Thunder music. Hmm. So then you mean this thing right here.
Absolutely.
I had to buy it, but I got in contact with a guy who was putting it out, and so we have vinyl. But yeah, that was very strange how that went down.
So what was the original name of the band?
It was Thunder.
And where did Cutthroat come from?
Something you before.
One of the songs.
Okay.
One of the songs on the album is Cutthroat.
Right, but they decided to name the band that at some point, unbeknownst to you.
Who's they? I don't even know who they is.
Right.
It was just some guy.
Okay,
that
I see.
Guitar player made a deal with, and he got a little jack, you know, and well, that's
wow.
And where did Atomic Cocktail come from?
Same thing, probably, right?
Same thing.
Really?
Same wow, exact thing. He just created it and told us about it later.
Because yeah. I have a silver pressed CD of it called with Atomic Cocktail. I have it actually.
Yeah. And that cover has the original singer in it.
Yeah.
Who isn't even on the CD.
Oh, jeez.
Really? Okay. Wow.
Learning all this stuff.
I'm glad I opened this kettle of fish.
It's a mess.
It sounds like it.
So how did that band do? Like, was there any success level to it? Did you tour, or was it just like, oh,
no. We had a little bit of interest with the demo in Europe, of course, Europe, not here. And we played clubs, you know, in the metal scene around here in the Tampa Bay area.
And you practice in a guitar in a garage and ate pizza.
Right. That's it.
Now, how did you meet Ralph Santola? How did that come about?
How did I meet him? Well, I hadn't even heard of him until I guess the word got out that at Moore Sound Recording that there's a new band called Eyewitness. They were looking for a singer, and I just don't even know how I actually met him, but I know I wanted an audition, so I talked to some people, and they set it up, and got the gig, and we immediately went into overdrive. We started writing. We started playing shows at the Rocket Club in Tampa. And our third or fourth gig, we were opening for Warrant. Yeah. And the funny thing about Warrant was that Jerry Dixon became friends with the band and was trying to get us a deal. Yeah. But California already knew in 1992, they knew things had changed.
They knew it was up.
They knew that, yeah. And they knew grunge was coming. So that's when they recorded Dog Eat Dog in Tampa.
Oh, okay.
And they were trying to change their look, their...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The sound. Yeah, totally.
And everything.
Yeah.
Because they knew what was going on. And here we are, this happy little love metal hair band. Because we're in Florida. We're a couple of years behind everything. Mm-hmm. And... So we played a lot around here, and then I think it took a couple of years before we sent demos and got a deal with Now and Then Records. Mm. And then he did a separate deal, I guess, with Brunette and some others.
That was Mark Ashton, right?
Mark Ashton.
Right? Yeah.
So we put out in 95, we put out an album. Eyewitness, the debut, and we got to go to London and play at the Astoria, the Gods Festival.
Yes.
And we had made it. I mean, we were out walking on holy ground. Yeah. And we knew it. We're on our way now. And then we came home and we wrote a new album, and it's my favorite still, but it bombed.
Messiah Complex.
And I guess everybody, it was like, no, it's not right. You're this. You can't do that. And it's just the way we were feeling at the time. We didn't try to write it heavier or darker. It just kind of turned out that way.
Well, it's kind of like what you said with Warrant. You know, they kind of changed gears. It was a changing of the scene at that time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had to huddle up. Mark said, hey, do something. So we had a name change and went back to the old style, some of the old demos, and came up with Millennium. And a lot of those songs were some of the earliest ones. So that's more like it. And people seem to dig that more in Europe and Japan. Mm. So that's when we got a tour with 10, and we got to go. We played the Gods Festival in the UK, and then went and toured a little bit through Europe on their bus, and got to be good friends with them. And it was just that was magic. Again, we thought, okay, we're back on track, and so that was the Millennium debut.
How was that driving around on a bus in Europe? Wasn't 10 like six or seven guys in the band? And then you had all your band all in one bus.
I think there was five or six.
Okay.
There's six guys, I think, in that band.
Yeah. Six guys.
Okay.
Yeah. And then us think we were four piece at that time.
Okay.
And we just had a ball and got to go in Munich. They put us, they said, well, 10 is not going to be available. So they stuck us on this live TV show doing lip sync into our songs.
Yeah.
A couple of songs. And that was so, I don't think I've ever been more nervous because I had little ears in, right? And we're listening to this beautiful couple talk about, it was like Regis and Kathy Lee, you know, talking about, they're asking us questions and we have to wait for the interpreter in our ear. She wants to know if you like the girls in Germany. Stuff like that, you know, it's like, so there's this delay. It was crazy.
Yeah.
So we had a good time there. Came back to the States, wrote another album, Angel Fire, and felt pretty good about it. You know, we said, hey, we're developing as songwriters finally. And we waited and we said, oh, well, we're going to get something going here. We're going to get you to Europe. And the label was having trouble, I guess, and things weren't happening. And we just waited and waited and waited. And nothing was happening. Meanwhile, I was asked to audition for a Doobie Brothers offshoot of three former members of the Doobie. So I'm like, wow, this is kind of cool. And I actually get to do some shows as a headliner in the States. And we're still waiting on Angel Fire. I think it got released, but nothing, there was no promotion. We didn't go anywhere. So I'm like, hey, I've got this thing with the Doobies, you know, the former Doobies. And I'm having a good time and I'm getting paid good money. And so, Ralph, what are we going to do? And he said, well, just, you got to do what you got to do. Mm. So I moved on to that and didn't hear anything for a while. And then all of a sudden I heard that Jorn Lande had joined the band.
That was one of our questions. As Tom and I were just talking about that, how you did two albums with the band Millennium. And then all of a sudden the third album comes out with Jorn Lande. And it's like, then you end up coming back at one point.
Is it Lande?
Lande, whatever you want to. Jorn.
All I know is he's a badass. Oh, and they did a great album.
Hourglass.
Hourglass was a great album. And they came through before they went to Spain, and they came and played in Clearwater in my hometown.
Oh, really?
And I went and saw them, and I got to hang out with the guys. It was so surreal hearing him, who I had heard for years, you know, just kind of like idolized him. Him singing my lyrics in songs that I co-wrote. It was kind of surreal. But they were very, he was very gracious, and he's a consummate professional.
Yeah.
And so that I went off, did my thing with the former Doobies, eventually got the manager of that, took some liberties with the booking. Uh-oh. And we would show up at a gig, and it would say, Miller Lite welcomes the Doobie Brothers. So no, take that down. No. So we got sued. The Doobie Brothers sued him, this manager. He's gone now. I can talk about him. for $1 million.
Wow.
Cease and desist. Of course, he has to use certain size font. He can't say this and can't say that. But he couldn't resist, and he put out some of the demos that we did with a record label in California, of all places, where the Doobie Brothers are from. And that's when he really got sued, and we had to shut it down. So that was where we were. But this whole time, I'm like, you go, guy. You know, I was happy for Millennium. They got a little tour, but then Jorn left. And that it was just more, I think, more about the label, and they had problems, and I don't know. Mm. But we had a good run.
Yeah. Well, you came back and did another record, right?
Yeah, that was weird. Ralph had been writing, and he wanted to do this other record, but it was not Millennium. It was going to be something else. And I guess the label said, well, since it's you and Ralph, you might as well call it Millennium. And you got the name recognition and everything. So it's a very different kind of record, I think. It's heavier. I don't know. What do you think?
I would say it's much heavier than the stuff that was before it, without a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted to take you back to the Eyewitness stuff, because the first album for me at that time when it came out was a real breath of fresh air, because for fans like us in the U.S. that really were cut off from melodic hard rock, that band and that album really delivered what we wanted to hear. And I know the European audience too. Did you guys realize the impact that that album had at the time?
No. No, I think if we would have been on a different label, different situation, we might have. But no, we didn't know anything about that. In fact, Ralph was kind of the Yngwie of the group. Mm-hmm. So he took care of all the business and handled all the dealing with the label. He would just say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do another album. And God, I wish we would have just continued on with another one, a follow-up.
Yeah. And I mean, I like the second album, but I know it turned a lot of people off, because it had, it certainly wasn't a grunge album, but it had those dark overtones at times, right, which I personally loved it. But I know there were a lot of people that felt it was your band now abandoning that sound and going into the dark side, grunge, alternative, dark, you know, moody, you know.
I wish we would have just done that as a separate project.
As a project.
And just continued on with the Millennium stuff as Eyewitness too.
Right. And that decision was made solely because you went to that sound because that's what you wanted to play, or you just really didn't realize the impact that that first album had on the fan base?
Both. I mean, if I would have known, you know, if we would have gotten a tour, I bet you we would have seen, okay, there's something's brewing here. All we did was we went to London, we did the Gods, and came home. And then it was, Ralph was of the thought, let's just keep forging ahead. And so he would just start writing, and I was like, he'd send me a cassette or hand me one, and I would like be doing lyrics and music, melodies and stuff. And that's how Messiah Complex came about. It was just organic. We didn't think about changing sound. We just wrote that thing. And that was what was like going through our lives. At the time, I think we both had woman problems, and things were kind of dark in our lives. So it reflected in the music. The word love is not mentioned on that album.
Hmm.
A little trivia there. If someone can find the word love.
It's not a huge departure, but for those times, it was a big departure, because melodic rock fans were so anti anything that felt so like betrayed by the scene, that anything that resembled that, you were immediately blackballed, because you were labeled as a grunge sellout.
Right. That was not a conscious thing. Maybe we were affected by what we were hearing on the radio.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. No, I mean, I liked a lot of that stuff. That's why I liked that album. I wasn't anti that sound. To me, it was rock music, just a little more, you know, dark.
Yeah.
But
Jerry Dixon was trying to get us the deal, you know, in the States. It just never happened, never came about. But I would have been perfectly happy to do another, in that same vein of Eyewitness, just ramp it up a little bit. We had plenty of material.
Now, Ralph Santola was a guy that we didn't know him until that first Eyewitness album. He's not around to, for me to interview him. Where did he come? Because when that album came out, he automatically became like a god, like a guitar god. Like immediately, as soon as you heard that album, everybody wanted to know who the fuck this guy was. Who was he? Where did he come from?
He didn't even know that.
He didn't know that. Okay.
No, we didn't know that we had made any impact at all.
That's so depressing to hear, because you did. I could tell you somebody that I used to write for Mark Ashton's magazine, Boulevard. And I could tell you, you guys made a huge impact with that first album. Huge impact. But
woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Yeah, well, you left us a great album. That's, it's, to me, I go back. And you did a great cover of a classic UFO album, which was another, that was another way to score points. You tackle a UFO album and you do a great job with it.
Thank you. And we also did that group as a Japanese group from the song Far Away, Zeno.
Oh, Zeno. Yeah, yes.
We did a Zeno.
They're actually group. German.
Oh, they are.
They're German. They were huge in Japan. It's yeah. Uwe John Roth's younger brother. They would had a huge following in Japan, but they were Germans, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Flexig was the singer. Yeah, they were all Germans, but a huge Japanese following. Yeah, Far Away, right. That's right.
See, if we would have been somehow contacted by a promoter in Japan, things would have been different.
Yeah. Because you had all the elements. You had your voice, you had the crazy guitar player that everybody loved, that type of thing. We still
did. And he was crazy, but he was
melodic. Very melodic. Yes, exactly right. It wasn't just a flurry of notes. He played with a lot of melody. He was a terrific player. Sorely missed.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Cryptic Vision. How did you, and before you speak on it, on Messiah Complex, there were a couple of songs on there that I heard at the time. A lot of phrasings and things that reminded me of Steve Walsh. And I know you later worked with David Ragsdale. Was Steve Walsh in Kansas an influence of yours?
Absolutely. Yeah. This was like even before we knew what prog was. I knew it was progressive rock, but what was so cool was, as far as the Cryptic Vision, I was working with an engineer, drummer, producer. He does everything. He plays all the instruments. And we just did this album that he had written called Moments of Clarity. And it wasn't a band. It was just me and him. And he did all the instruments. And then he had some people come in, including Ragsdale, and do solos and stuff. And it wasn't until 3 years later that we decided we're going to write another album and do it live. So we had to put a band together. But another ironic twist there was that about our third gig, we opened for Kansas.
Really?
And Walsh was still with him back then. It was, in fact, Robbie was still with him back then. But we got to do some really great shows. We, for about a 2 year period, we played just around here. We did some of the festivals and went to California, went to near Philly. And we did our last gig before we kind of fizzled out. We opened for Asia, the original Asia.
Really?
They reformed in, I think it was 07.
Yeah, the reunion.
Or 08, something like that. So I got to meet the whole band. And That was amazing.
Wow.
John Wetton, great guy, treated us wonderfully. I walked into a room backstage, and there's Steve Howe with an acoustic guitar just warming up, doing like Mood for a Day in the Clap.
Oh, boy.
And yeah, that was a moment.
Nice.
But yeah, so we did In a World was our second album with the real band, and then our third album of Infinite Possibilities. Mm-hmm. We did not do anything live until 2019, where we had a reunion. But those three albums, Moments of Clarity in a World of Infinite Possibilities, all the like the trio of songs of the titles put together.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear that you were such a big fan of Kansas, because I was re-listening to some of the albums over the last 2 days, and on Messiah Complex, there's a couple of songs toward the middle to the end of the album that I could hear different phrasings and your style of singing that reminded me of Walsh. And I didn't even know that.
Much appreciated.
I didn't even know that Ragsdale had, until I went back to the CDs and saw that you played with Ragsdale, and then I said, well, you know, that might be a connection, that there was a big Kansas influence.
Oh, I wish I didn't even meet Ragsdale when during all the recording. We would send him tapes.
Okay.
He would just do these blazing, incredible solos.
Oh, he was a beast.
Send it back. And we're like, okay. And he could, like, okay, this will work great here. This, mm-hmm. you know, piecing it together. Rick Duncan is the mastermind of Cryptic Vision.
Yeah, I kind of figured.
And
yeah.
He put all that together. I finally met Rags at a Kansas show years later. But yeah, he did some incredible work. Just like a machine.
Yeah, he was great. I know Mark has a few things he wants to throw at you.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you about, because you guys sent your bio and all your stuff prior to this, you know, recording of this. And I'm looking here, and you did a ton of like jingle work and things like that. Now, we've had guests on in the past where we've had guys like Stan Bush and other guys that have been on our show.
Jerome Mazza.
Jerome Mazza, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know Jerome Mazza?
He's from here.
Yeah. We had him on the show about 2 years ago. Great guy.
Talk about Steve Walsh.
Yeah, well, yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Did an album with them. They did an album together. Yeah.
And did some of the lead. I mean, he's that good.
Yeah, Jerome Mazza is terrific. Super nice guy, too.
Pinnacle Point.
Yeah. Pinnacle Point. What a great band, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Incredible stuff.
Yeah.
But how did you kind of get in there? Because we hear that story from a bunch of guys we've had on the podcast. That how do you get into that jingle thing? What was the driving force behind that?
I don't know. There's guys around here that, you know, when you're a singer and you're not in a band or you're in between stuff, you hear about, hey, I know this guy in the next town over that's got a studio, and he hires, you know, he hires singers to come in and do different, you know, female singers and metal singers and different voices. And so I started doing jingles, and then it ends up like 10 years later, the guy that hired me to do jingles is now in a band with me now. He's the bass player.
Ah.
But I know where you're going.
Keep going.
Is it the one thing I want to ask you, and we mentioned it before, the Hulk Hogan theme song. We gotta ask you about that. Everybody knows
that's right, brother.
how did that all come about?
Ralph and I were doing the first album, the first Eyewitness, 93, I think, 94. We're doing some, you know, demoing or something in Morrisound. And Jimmy Hart comes in.
Really?
Great guy. And so full of energy. And he's like, yeah, I'm looking for a guitar player and a vocalist to do a song. Here, just sign this release. okay. And he paid us, you know, cash to do this the song that he had written. And it ends up going on like two different CDs for Hulk Hogan. And yeah, that was pretty cool. I'm still on the coattails of that. I saw Terry Hogan in the grocery store the other day.
Oh, really?
He said, "You know, man, I'm a, you know, not only a fan, but I sang your song." It's like that was his fight song for years.
Yes.
American Made, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And if I would have gotten a nickel for every time they played that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
I could have bought a house. But
so he lives right near you?
He lives in Clearwater. Yeah. He's got a home.
Well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about too was, I mean, obviously you're a Florida guy. I know you did some backing vocals on the Sabotage album, Edge of Thorns. I mean, obviously that's got to be probably one of my top two Sabotage favorite albums. Tom and I are both big Sabotage guys. Talk about that and, you know, your connection with Sabotage.
They were just a local band.
Sure.
You know, they had a deal with Atlantic, though. They were the first, first band to really just start taking off. And again, we're in Morrisound, and they said, "Hey, we need some guys to do some gang vocals." Oh, okay. I happen to sing a little. Mm. And we did a few. I think we did Damien and Lights Out. And I can't remember what else on there, but they only used one or two.
Okay.
But it was a great, you know, meeting Paul O'Neill. And isn't he from New Jersey?
Is he?
Yes.
Is he New Jersey? Okay.
He is.
He's a Jersey guy. Okay.
Yeah. And Chris.
Mm.
Wow. What a guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
And
what a visionary. You know, what a visionary that guy was. I mean, he wrote all of that stuff. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah. And I think it was 94. We were playing a festival north of Tampa. And it was like a 3-day festival. A lot of bands there. We were one of the openers. And we heard the news that he'd been in a car crash while we were there. He was on his way to that festival.
Oh, wow.
And from then on, that whole festival, there was a pall over it because we knew Chris was gone.
Wow.
It was horrible.
I actually saw that. It was probably, I would say, about a month before his passing. I saw Sabotage up here in New Jersey. And I can almost remember when I heard, just like you talk about, when I heard that news, and I was like, I just saw him last month, you know, and it was just heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a weird time. There was a lot of Ray Gillen died.
Yeah.
Carl Albert from Vicious Rumors died in a car accident, another monster singer. And Chris Olive. I always look at those three. The scene was already changing, not for the better.
Yeah.
And we lost three tremendous talents in the scene, like within a year.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah.
I also did some, you know, being the go-to guy at Morrisound for a while there. And Iced Earth is a Tampa band.
Yes.
And he had me come in with some other singers, and we did backing vocals on a couple of theirs. But I think the second one was with Ripper Owens.
Mm.
And I'll never forget standing toe to toe with Ripper. And I was already a Priest fan from way back.
Mm.
And we're doing backing vocals, you know, pushing each other. And that was a great memory.
Wow.
You also were involved with a band that I liked a lot too called Monarch, if you recall that. A guy named Jimmy Dorian was the singer. And they got signed to the same label you were on, Alpha Brunette.
So you want some dirt on that?
Yeah, I'd love a little dirt on that.
Of course you do. Monarch was not a band.
It was a project of sorts?
It was a project.
Yeah.
The photo on the back?
It's not them?
It's a bunch of guys with long hair.
Really?
Yeah. Some of them weren't even musicians.
Really? Wow.
It's like, okay, well, you need some guys to, you know, to pose for this So really, Monarch was Ralph and I, who I had written some of the songs with him. And he was talking about doing a Todd Plant solo album. I'm like, if I'm going to do a solo album, I really kind of want some more input into it. I want to craft it a little more. But he says, well, they need an album quick. So I said, why don't you get Jim and we'll work together. So all those backing vocals and even some of the co-lead vocals on that album are me.
So who was Jim Dorian? He was a local singer that you knew?
Local singer, yeah. Had great hair. I mean, his hair was down past his ass.
Well, was he at least in the picture of the band?
I think he was in the picture.
Yeah, because there was a guy with tremendously long blonde hair
in the
picture. So it was him and a bunch of guys you pulled off a street corner. It's actually a really good record. There's a couple of song. The first song, City of Lost Angels, is tremendous.
Yeah, that was one of the Eyewitness demos.
Oh, was it really?
Wow.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know that.
Quite a few of those songs were.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm glad I asked you about that. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, Monarch.
And they got signed on Alpha Brunette also.
Yes.
Which I guess was a little help from you guys being associated with.
Yeah. Yeah, the band that never was.
That's very funny.
I'll look at that album now in a different light now.
And Camelot came through, did their debut album.
Oh, you did.
In Morrisound. I was.
Oh, you were involved with the early Camelot stuff? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm
because that was another Florida band, yeah.
Doing a lot of backup singing. And let's see. Oh, Wicked Mariah.
I remember them too. That name. Yeah.
I think they're a Jersey band.
I was gonna say I know they're not from Florida. They might
they're
be
Long
from
Island.
They're definitely an East Coast band. Yeah.
Yeah, I sang on that, and then in 2020, in between Iced Earth album, I guess John Schaefer got
sent to prison.
Well, no, almost.
Oh, we did.
We're not there yet.
Okay,
but he did a Demons and Wizards album number. I guess the third one.
Three, yes.
And I sang on that one. Mm. And then he went to prison.
Okay, I was going to say. I know he did one because I remember reading in the papers.
Well, he got pardoned, right?
I mean, yeah,
but he got pardoned. Yeah, yeah.
We don't worry about it now.
he's a good guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I want to go. Let's go full circle with you now. We talked about all the original bands and everything. Let's talk about it. We talked about it briefly before we went on the air here. You've got a band that does a lot of different other tributes to things like Steve Miller, Doobie Brothers, Sting and the Police, U2, Santana, 38 Special. Tell us how this all comes about. How do you get one band, the guys that want to pay tribute to all those artists?
Well, it started out, I joined a Santana tribute and then it continued on. And then later on, after the Doobie Brothers thing fell apart, I said, okay, I'm going to do a tribute. So now I have two tributes that were separate bands. And then I kind of melded them together and became the leader of both of those. And then we just kept adding, you know, like the agent said, hey, I need a 38 special. Okay. We'll start doing it. And I took our percussion player, who's a lead singer, and I stuck him out front and let him do most of the lead vocals. You're the Donnie Van Zant guy, kind of guy. And I wanted to just really enjoy playing rhythm guitar and some leads. And Steve Miller and Sting and the Police and U2. It's fun stretching out and singing Bono and Sting. And man, it's a real challenge.
So are you out there every weekend playing with
Maybe two or three times a week. month.
Okay.
Sometimes more.
Okay.
But I'm an older guy now. I don't bounce back quite as quite as easy as I used to. So I like to. I don't like doing back to backs. You know.
Gotcha.
Give me a day to recuperate a little bit.
Right.
But there is something going on that I didn't tell you about that we uncovered an eyewitness board mix from 1992. From the Rocket Club, and we did a lot of studio wizardry to separate everything and make it stereo and enhance the vocals and pull this up and remix it and remaster it until Jim Morris is he's a wizard in the studio. And so now we're going to release an Eyewitness Live album. And it was like, wait, let's see if we have any more demos. So we've been digging up all these old demos and finding some great songs.
Really?
That never got put on anything. So right now, in fact, tomorrow night, I'm going in the studio to start listening to some of the old demos that we had. The tapes were sent off and dried, like they baked them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And digitized them. So now we have like multi-track digital.
Wow.
We can actually remix and master some. So there will be something. I don't know how we're going to release it. Maybe just, streaming. But I just love holding a CD in hand.
Well, that was, we're still CD collectors to this day. And I was going to say, if you release it, please put it on CD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? You got to remember something. Most of your audience is Europeans, and Europeans still buy CDs.
Uh-huh.
Americans don't, but well, Europeans do.
And older fans, too. We love that physical product.
The physical product is not as dead as a lot of people want to make you think it is.
Well, look at the artwork on the Cryptic Vision CDs. They're a booklet with just one after another of just great art and lyrics and the liner notes. And it's a snapshot of a moment in time for a band.
Sure.
That I think it's become so sterile now with just the streaming.
Oh yeah.
It's just a line of words.
Yeah.
You click on those words. Ah, yeah, it's great. But I'm with you. CDs away and you can crank that baby up. Of course, none of the cars have a CD player.
No,
true.
No, that's
intentionally tried to kill them.
Right.
That's right. So do you have any type of a timeline on this Eyewitness stuff? Are you looking at something in this year, 25, or are we going beyond that?
Well, like I said, we're really just uncovering all of these demos. So I don't know, but it would be great if we could get something out this year, and you will be the first ones to hear about it.
Excellent, thank you.
Are you still in touch with the original guy, like Oliver, the drummer, and like, are you still in touch with them?
Yeah, Oliver's. Yeah, I'm still in touch with him, and the bass player of Millennium. Well, there was three, but there's still a few of the guys that I'm in touch with like the original bass player and rhythm guitarist of Eyewitness that were, I don't know how much of them was on the first album, but they're all around here.
Does Oliver still play?
I don't think he plays much. I think he does for fun.
He was a terrific drummer. I thought he had a great sound. He had a huge sound.
Yeah. So solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a great band. Terrific.
We used to do shows. We used to do shows where I shouldn't probably say this, but we were early in the using tracks because a couple of the guys, like the original guitarist and bass player didn't sing very well. And Oliver didn't sing. So we had all these beautiful stacked vocals of me doing these harmonies. So we would have a guy backstage playing, like, I don't know if it was DAT tape or something. I don't think it was cassette. I'm going to see him tomorrow. I'm going to find out. But we would, you know, use these backing vocals. We'd have to, you know, Oliver would have to be listening to this click track to make sure we didn't get off. But that was in the very early days of Eyewitness. Mm. So hopefully you will be hearing some of the songs that that never made it.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. That should have made it.
That would be great. I would love to see that happen.
And a lot of them, that a lot of these are songs that you'll hear a whole section be like, wait a minute, that's on this song on that album. Hmm. So you'll be able to, you know, say,
right.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, that's something to really look forward to.
Please put it on CD. Even if it's a small press.
There you go.
All right. Absolutely.
Anything else, Tom?
I'm good.
You're good? Todd, we appreciate this this talk tonight. Lots of good info, lots of good stories.
Great stuff.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we appreciate it, and looking forward to new Eyewitness stuff, of course. New old stuff, but whatever.
New old stuff.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye now.
All right. Take care. Good night.
Take care.
Close your eyes to everything.